Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight I'm excited to have on Don Williams, who's a professional speaker, author, and educator who teaches people to become the best version of themselves by realizing their maximum potential in their health, wealth, and relationships. To accomplish this, he created the Human Instruction Manual and related courses. When Don was 10, he had a nearly fatal brain and spine injury that completely paralyzed him from the neck down. Amazingly, he recovered in less than 6 months, and to this day, doctors consider Don a living miracle. Second was his call to action. In corporate America, he was recycled as the last in to the first out, despite the fact his efficiency and effectiveness led to making his employers millions. His gratitude for living through it all fuels his passion to help, train, and educate as many people as he can. Due to Don's natural resilience, he has pioneered assisting above-average people to become extraordinary human beings by taking them from zero to hero. And so let me introduce Don and ask you once again how you're doing tonight.
I am doing outstanding. Thank you very much, David. I appreciate you having me on the show.
It's my pleasure, and I love you saying outstanding. I bet you say that all the time.
Yes, I do. And there are some people who just don't know how to take that. It's such a strong word, and it says quite a lot when you say it, that people get taken aback. Because there's almost like an energy that you can't help but feel when you hear it.
Well, you know, the thing is, a lot of people just don't seem to get that they can be in that place most, if not all, of the time. And, you know, of course, life throws us some curveballs now and then, and we are human beings with emotions. And we don't want to deny those emotions, but we can coast through them so that we can get back to that place in a relatively short period of time. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And just to start off real quick here, to give your audience and yourself a little bit of a frame of reference to work off of, life as it is taught to us through human society makes us polarized or tend to be polarized towards an extreme one or the other. And people wonder why they can't seem to get traction on what they want to do. But if you're looking at a wall and all you're doing is seeing your shadow, you're going to wonder what's going on. People don't recognize that between the two poles is the center, and that's where everything happens. It's a balance between everything on both sides, and it shifts a little bit in each direction as you change, as you grow.
Well, how do you recommend staying in a place of balance? Because I certainly believe life is a balancing act and that there are several variables at play. What would you have to say about that?
Well, first is that as much as this world makes you have to get caught up in other people's problems and challenges, that don't make their urgency your important. Focus on what you need to do at the time you need to do it and learn to put the distractions away and say no to everything that doesn't meet your need at the moment. One of the things that I really stress with people is you have to do self-supporting actions. But self-supporting actions at the same time can reflect a service to others if you remain at that point where you recognize that there is no value in service to self, such that you can meet your needs, you can help other people out while meeting your needs, but you don't have to take away from anybody else. You can add to other people, and everyone else is going to win, and yourself. And that'll keep you in more balance. When you're worrying about, oh, I don't have this, or I don't have that, or climbing or racing up to the top of the greasy pole just to be, say, you're on top, no matter what happens, everything is always in flux and always changing, right? Because this, the flow of life is consistent with your journey, not anybody else's. Don't focus on what other people are doing. Focus on what you need to do. There's no way you're going to be able to take the next step if you're worried about someone else.
That's very true. And we are powerless over everything but ourselves, yet we tend to draw experiences. This is my philosophy, and tell me what you think about it. But we do tend to attract experiences to ourselves that are a reflection of where we're at. What do you think about that?
I think that is fairly close to the way it works. I think where it gets a little fuzzy is there are some things that you have to face or you have to deal with. And if you haven't passed them up properly in your past journeys, you're holding on to them in some way, whether you're consciously or unconsciously aware of it. And so even though you may have current place, time, and the present desires, you're anchored to those other things until you deal with them and let them go through what they need to go through. And a lot of time, as humans, at least in the Western culture, people suffer from what I call the reverse anger challenge. And this is because when parents are trying to govern their life and have some peace and quiet, more or less, they tell little Johnny or little Susie, don't cry, don't yell, don't scream, don't whatever. But they're telling that to a child at that time when they don't have the ability to articulate or communicate anything, or very limited. And it starts programming inside that when you want to communicate and you're challenged with it, you need to stifle it. And our body, the way it's set up, is kind of like what I call being the driver of a vehicle. Okay? If you get inside a car, there's all little dials and knobs and all the buttons that tell you what's going on, and there are ones you get to interact with. Well, your feelings work as those signals. And they're there just to keep you aware of where you are. It's not supposed to be a knee-jerk response. It's supposed to be an intelligent awareness of what the feeling is telling you so that you can act upon it appropriately. So when you have this sense of anger, it's really telling you there is something you have to deal with. You need to communicate something. And you need to make sure you express this now because you may not have another opportunity, or if so, for a while, and this will bother you. And most people who, when they immediately feel anger, if they just say, you know, what you said irritated me, or the way that this was handled really affected me, et cetera, whatever the example is, and just put it out on the table. Most people are afraid of what is going to happen, and the anger stems from being afraid of what happens if you can just put it out on the table as what it is and just let it be. So they turn it around to all this other stuff because they got it all backwards inside.
Well, of course, if we hold on to anger, that can lead to all kinds of toxic things like resentments. And it just builds and feeds on itself. But I like what you're saying, and I totally agree that we do carry a certain amount of baggage from past whatever. I mean, trauma, things that children don't understand, that they're told, that don't make sense to them. And it always comes back to that if we run into a roadblock along the way.
Okay.
If we're blocked in our emotions in some fashion or other.
I have a question for you, David. Are you a parent at all?
No, I'm not. I'm not a parent.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Never had the pleasure.
So you've never been a parent before. So if you were to be a parent and you tried being a parent and you didn't have any mentors or guides because society has broken apart the family, so you're not like connecting with grandparents and you're not really collectively together more. You're more spread out like the way our society has gotten. And
right.
you're going to do the best you can with what you know, right?
Absolutely.
But one of the things that I tell all the people that I work with, and it's really clearly stated in my book, and I put this up front, there are three ways of looking at things. There's you know what you know, you also know what you don't know, or at least think you don't know, and you know who to go to get that information.
Mm-hmm.
But the third level of thinking is this: you don't know what you don't know. Can you embrace your ignorance? Only by embracing your ignorance will you remain open to what's happening in the present and not cloud yourself and overthink it. So when a parent doesn't know any better, they're going to do the best thing they can at the time. And
right.
They don't know what they don't know. And
right.
So what happens is you have somebody who doesn't know what they don't know doing the best what they can at the moment, and that leaves an impression on whomever they're interacting with. So we're using
mm-hmm.
a parent-child example, but it could be anything in the workplace, a relationship, friends, whatever. And
right.
One of the things I help people grasp, it's not difficult, but it takes a little bit of a comparison. Our society is highly driven towards owning things and having things, and all that revolves around this concept that humans created called money. In nature, money doesn't exist, and everything in nature is fine. But we created this idea of money, and we're caught up in it. And the idea of making money has to do with compounding the interest, making it pay dividends, and making one number multiply itself, right? Well, that is very unnatural to some degree and very natural in another way. However, human society, when you link this concept up with this compounded interest situation and this idea that most people don't know what they don't know, they're going with opinions and theories, and a lot of what may appear to be a fact is just a fact based off of what someone else may have said, but there's so much going on, it's hard to verify, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens here is human society unknowingly works on a level of compounded ignorance. People who don't know any better telling other people
right.
what to do as if it's true or fact with the best of intention, but passing it along.
Mm-hmm.
And when
I totally
we talk
agree
about,
with that.
And when we talk about business, I tell people, if you have developed the desire to really perceive and become aware and you pay attention to words, when you work, unless you're independent in what you do, you're going to work for a business. But look at what the word business is when spelled out. It's busyness. Business
yeah.
is about busyness. It's about keeping people busy. And it's about pursuing this compounded interest with the money so they can have more. And constantly, you can never have enough. Whereas when you can recognize that the compounded ignorance is a factor, you can say, I'm enough where I am now, and I seek to be more, but the only way I can be more is if I can accept I don't know what I don't know. It totally flips the whole concept.
Well, I think that's a real mark of humility when a person can say that they don't know something and put it out there and remain open. I have run into situations in my past where I have not had that humility, and it's taken a long lifetime and gathering wisdom from the wisdom of other people and recognizing that the things that I used to think I knew, I didn't know, and that I'm learning all the time, as we all are, and one never stops learning.
Now, I want to help you lift a little bit of weightiness based off of the comment you just made, okay?
Okay.
There's this age range, late teenage, early teenage years, that in society, people will say these age ranges think they know it all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when in that age range, they look at everyone older than them, and they're like, why are you making it so complicated? It just do this. And in their frame of reference within their groups that are outside of the busyness of life that adults have created, that function pretty much works within those groups because of two things. One, it's the blind leading the blind. So it's at that age they don't know any better, but they're leading each other. So it's going down that dark tunnel without having any light, but at least they're willing to go that direction together. They feel they're more connected, whereas everyone else seems disconnected. The other thing that is actually quite valid in what they say is at that moment, they haven't hit the wall. And to me, this wall is a metaphorical thing. And you've heard people, I'm sure, in all the New Age and all the spiritual and all the concepts relating to things with regards to the word blocks, right? People have blocks. And people are like, what the heck is this block? Help me understand this block. In theory, I hear the word, but what is a block? And I express the way to clarify this in this way. When you go through life, you have a choice to build your life. And you build it one of two ways. You have to make the connection between the inner world and the outer world so you can build a bridge with bricks, or that brick becomes a block and you build a wall and you can't cross the chasm.
Mm.
When you're a teenager, you haven't hit the wall yet. You're thinking you've got figured out because you're just growing into your adulthood. You're connecting with your emotions and your body and your thoughts, and it's in this maturation stage. But most people hit the wall around 18 to like 24 or whatever when they go into the so-called real world, which is nothing but unreal. And it's this adult-created fantasy. And what happens is people will go through school. People will do what they were told when they were younger. They will go into the busyness of life, and it's like everything that I taught was one way, seems to be backwards to some degree, and no one wants to really talk about it. They talk about it in passing, but they never really want to get to the root of it. They don't want to accept it. And because what's really happening is the elephant in the room, the gigantic elephant in the room, is everyone's going through this internal chaos dealing with human society. They're hitting this wall, but they have no vocal point, no frame of reference for anybody else because everyone thinks there's something severely amiss with them. They're like, why is everything so backwards? Why is it that everything that I was taught to do seemed to make sense, but when I enter the world that I always wanted to be in, it's nothing but? And that's what I help people reestablish. This connection between the inner and outer world and building that bridge, knocking down that wall, and recognizing that the connection of with the body is to just to have the human experience and not get absorbed into the fact that you're the body. and to
right.
recognize that what we call the mind is not our brain, it's our thoughts and our feelings. And
mm-hmm.
if you look at anything in electrical terms, there's a positive and a negative. We don't want to look at it in those terms as far as positive and negative, because there's a lot of connotations to that. But there are two poles, two extremes, which I said before. And what happens is men, as we are socialized and because of our biology, we tend to be thought, feeling, thought. We have a thought first, then we generate the feeling that we associate with that thought, and then that predicates another thought. Women tend to be the reverse. They tend to be emotion, thought, emotion. Not to say that men or women can't be having either's going on, but as you see, it's constantly going thought, emotion. And that dynamic of the switching of that energy, so to speak, is what creates our essence to be in an active motion through existing. So people who will talk about intention, well, in order to be intention, there must be tension. And the tension is created by the thought and the feeling. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And so what this energy that we feel that's inside us, you know, there'll be people who say in religious senses, you have a soul. And they are the same people who will really say you have this body, and what you do with this body is unclean and everything else like this, when they're trying to make you feel less than who you are. But when you take the idea that you are the driver of the vehicle, and to help people illustrate this, in addition to that idea of being a driver and sort of a car, if you go into space, you have to wear a space suit. If you go to the bottom of the ocean, you have to wear a diving suit. If you go out in somewhere in a very cold polar region, you have to wear garments to allow you to support that, or if you're in some severe desert, correct? The point
mm-hmm.
being is to be in those places, you have to be in some sort of something in addition to your body to keep you alive. Now, when we decided to be alive, we decided to wear this genetic space suit. Any suit that we replicate in these environments is a reflection of the suit we're already wearing. There's communication devices. There's ability to see. There's ability to hear. There's ability to breathe. And so that's the kind of idea that people fall in confusion with. So when I went through this experience of breaking my neck, I had this period where I, like it says, paralyzed. I couldn't move. And at the initial phases of the story, the first 2 days of it, first 48 hours, all adults failed me basically because they thought I was making this up. At no time was I screaming or yelling or upset or anything. I was trying to be as calm, cool, and collected as I could be while I was paying attention, perceptive, and aware of everything that was going on within me and out in the world around me at the same time. And the only thought that went through my mind was, this is all going to take care of itself. I don't care how. It wasn't a doubt in my mind that it was going to take care of itself. The
mm-hmm.
interesting part was, how is this going to happen?
I would imagine.
And
how did it happen?
And as I laid there, unless you have the experience, it's very difficult to relate to this. When I initially broke my neck, here's what I was doing. My parents were way out of town. My mom had divorced when I was about 5 years old, and she married when I was about 7. At the age, now I'm 10 years old. I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger than me, so he's 8 years old. And I have an older brother who's 7 years older than me, so he's 17. over the years, my mom was divorced and then dating the man she eventually married, my older brother would often watch us. No surprise, this is pretty common. Although I had a mindset and a personality that was very strong-willed in mind and in body, and my older brother really wanted to take advantage and shape that energy within me when I was younger. So he wanted me to play sports. He was training me in running and all sorts of different things, and I was playing football with his friends. And they were 7 years older than me. And they would actually, at times, there were a few of them that were afraid to come to our house, and they would literally call ahead to find out if I was there without my older brother being there, because a couple times they gave me a lip, and I said, hey, guys, stop it. I don't like this. I like that recognizing the anger thing, putting it out there, and said, if you keep it up, I'll follow through, and you won't like it. And they looked at my brother, and he thought, oh, okay. Kind of gave him the look like, nope, you don't want to do that. And they didn't believe him, and I followed through. And so that's the type of personality I have, right? And, of course, we're all boys, so we're all playing. We all tend to play kind of rough with the things we did. One of the things that my brothers recount with a lot of humor and laughter is we had what we called spatula wars, where we would each get a spatula in each hand, you know, whatever we could grab out of the kitchen, and we would actually use that as like little weapons that you would, you know, jab or snap or whatever, somebody on the legs or wrists or arms or whatever. And the game would be like a gang up. How could you survive the other two who are ganging up on you? That type of thing. So for me to play tag in the house, you know, this is already a really engaged, all-in experience. And what I did, I had done before. I run towards the arm of a couch, and I do the tuck and roll of the arm of the couch into the seat of the couch, and then I would do like a bounce and, you know, put you like 3 or 4 feet in front of the person who's like in front of you. And this time I did it, but when I did it, my head laid square behind a pillow, and this is where I had a hard time relating to what was happening, and I can see why anybody that I explain this to would have a hard time too. I thought for a second I may have been dead. I thought for a second I may have been a ghost, because I could see everything around me, but I couldn't feel anything. It was like I was there, but I wasn't there.
Oh.
And the only thing that I could have any sense of texture feeling on became apparent within seconds, because my younger brother thought, because all of a sudden I stopped, I was playing possum. So he started beating me over the head with a pillow.
Oh, God.
And I was like, whoa. There's not much I could do here. Now, the body is in its natural sense of shock, and that affects your ability to breathe and so forth and so on, but I couldn't even feel that. In addition to that, your ability to speak, especially since where the injury took place, so far up next to my brainstem, there was no control of any of the muscles or any of the movements that allowed there to be any real valuable interaction with my vocal cords. The only thing that I had was the natural vacuum in my lungs while breathing out to say I could not move. And I'm sure he could barely hear me as he was pummeling me with a pillow.
Oh, my God. Whoa.
If that doesn't make matters worse, this next one will. And to this day, my younger brother says he has no idea what made him do this. But it makes for a great story now. He took off one of his socks and shoved it in my mouth.
Hmm.
Because his thought was, he's not going to move while I'm beating him over the head. Maybe he'll move if I do this. He wanted to see how resistant I would be to, you know, his torture. And I was able to push out the sock with my tongue, and he started getting the impression that maybe something wasn't right, and he could hear that I was trying to get his attention, and basically, you know, he recognizes, whoa, there's something the matter here. Gets a hold of my brother, my brother does some things with my leg or my arm, and I don't respond the way he would intend or thought that I would. So he calls out the ambulance. The ambulance comes over. They put the foam neck thing on me, put me on the stretcher, zing me off to the hospital. You know what? They don't do any x-rays. They don't take any diagnostics. They put me in a room with a giant light on top. No, I can't make this stuff up. They put me in a giant room with a giant light on top of me. I have literally sock mouth because the sock was in my mouth. It's very dry. I'm thirsty. I had this hot light on me that I could feel only my face. I can't see my body because they have me in one of these foam neck braces. And the one or two times that I have someone that comes into the room, I say, I'm very thirsty and I can't move. Can you please help me? And they basically say, we don't know what caused this. We don't know what's the matter with you. We can't do anything.
Why didn't they x-ray you?
I don't know. I don't know whether the fact that there wasn't any parents available or what the situation was. This was in 1987.
Yeah.
So at the time, I was living in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, Brooklyn. And parents, my mom and stepfather, were away over in Atlantic City. So this is far before cell phones, so they had to, like, call the hotel or casino or whatever and get a hold of them and have them figure out what was going on and call back and figure out what's going on and drive back and all sort of stuff. So there's a big time lag with them getting back and trying to get a hold of my birth father, who's in town, but he's doing his thing. And so I'm there, and here's what happens to me while I'm on the table. I have this strange feeling that I can only describe as what I can visualize through a normal context that people have seen. And if you've had any cultural experience with Star Trek and their beaming up or beaming down, the transporting thing, there's like that shimmery type look and that translucentness to the person. And I felt like I was phasing through the table. I don't know what else to explain it. My head, everything within my head was phased. It was kind of like my feet were falling to the ground, but yet I couldn't feel or move my body. It was the strangest thing. And I could feel all my emotions. So right there, I thought to myself, this issue that comes up with whether you have a soul or not, it's not whether you have a soul or not. You are your soul. And the energy of the soul is what gives you your feelings, both connectively when your body is connected properly and your emotional feelings. And your thoughts never waver, even though what's being connected is the spinal cord to everything, to the brain. So this is really interesting experience. And I thought, I must maybe be in some kind of a bad dream. This is just strange, and there's nothing I could do about this. And so I decided to, as you stated in your opening statements, I went in instead of outward. I recognized that the outside world was just as much of a part of a dream as any other dream I had, and that the only thing that I had was the inside world that I was experiencing, and it was very different from what I knew it to be. And this is where I have developed what I call the awareness of the perspective of the outside in or the inside out. And it's the perception and the point of reference you are existing in. Are you coming from where you are being the inside and your experience is outward? Or are you seeing yourself as a body that you're not really there and you're outside in, being that the outside world is dictating your inside experience?
Well, that seems to be the case with most people.
Right. And it's because of the way we're taught. And this goes back to the balance thing that we were talking about earlier. Obviously, when we're all born, we're infants. And we are in need of the outside world to take care of our needs because we cannot do so for ourselves. Okay? But this is where the conversation with reaching this period of the wall and whether you pass it comes up or not.
Yeah, because I'm
when
interested
you're younger,
in hearing
when,
about that.
When you're younger, you're in, whether you want to admit it or not, you're kind of in like a karmic debt. You're in debt to the society or your parents or whoever is providing you. Okay, you have to have total belief in the outside world to take care of you, because you can't do it on your own. And you're in a state of unconsciousness or bare consciousness, and as you're able to do more, you'll be able to be more conscious and more aware, and the balance of everything that was really given to you when you were younger starts to move a little bit, okay? But once you've grown into being an adult, all of a sudden, this first like 20 years of your life, the next 20, 40, 60 years of your life, the balance of your life, because like you go into a checking account and you have a balance, right? There's an unknown amount. You don't know how long you're going to live, but the balance remaining in your life is to equal the balance to everything that was given to you when you couldn't do it for yourself. That's why it's very important to be service to others.
Amen.
Because if you're service to self, you're only adding to your debt. Interesting concept.
Well, I couldn't
right?
agree more. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in this life with others. We're ultimately one as I see it, and we're not going to remain connected if we're self-serving.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm laying on this table, I'm dealing with this, and I said, you know, I'm tired. This must be a dream. I'm going to go sleep. Just made a conscious decision. I'm just going to close my eyes and go to sleep. Because the only thing I could look at was this bright light, so that wasn't any reason to keep my eyes open, and nobody was doing anything for me. So I'm not sure whether it was what I was actually laying on or if they transferred me to another bed. But when I woke in the morning, I awoke to hearing the clatter of one of these dietary people bringing in breakfast. And I was in a bed that was elevated, much like most of the beds are in like hospitals. So this time I could see myself a little bit better, and I could see what was going on around me versus just looking up at this light. And as this woman came over with this tray, because I noticed that she was serving other rooms and then finally came into mine, I said, "Oh, I am very thirsty. I cannot move. Can you please give me something to drink?" Now, this is where I started learning that people come from their own point of view and don't listen to where other people are coming from, because they're outside in and self-centric versus just taking something for what it is and letting it be. So if she would have said, "Oh, I'm here to help. Here's the juice. Here, let me help you drink that." And he can't move. I'll listen to him. But what she did was, she put the juice, you know, the tray, kind of moved it over on the bed, and she said, "Here." I said, "No, I can't move." So what she did is she thought, well, maybe I can't reach it, even though my hands were there. So she puts the juice, apple juice, whatever it was, in my hand, and because, of course, I have no ability to control my muscles or anything, it just dumps all over me. And she gets upset at me, because I told her what my condition was, as if I could do something about it. She did everything against what would be able to help me out, and she's upset at me. I thought, oh, I see how this is going to work for a while. That was my first experience with, nobody's going to get this until they get this. So until they get it, I just have to let them be and let myself know they don't know what they don't know, and that has to be okay, and I have to allow them to be that way. Which is a toughie. So I had to grow up.
How could
real
you ever
fast.
Do that at 10?
I know.
That's amazing. Amazing.
It was purely on the basis of need. That my need of self-supporting factors said, I have to work with this play that's going on with the way the play is organized, even though the play is not really set up to help me out. But the illusion was that it was. And I have to let that illusion, that baggage, that burden, that idea, let it go. So she leaves, and there's some period of time there. And apparently, whether it was at this time when she was bringing me in the tray or at some other time, there was a communication with regards to me peeing the bed. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. I don't remember peeing. I'm like, well, then I don't remember feeling anything. And so I'm apparently in a bed that's been peed, and then probably has this juice on it and all sort of stuff. So to them, you know, I'm a big mess. But yet the hospital was able to locate my father. And whoever was in charge of looking over me, I don't know what the title of the fellow, the guy was. he sort of sticks his head in. My dad sticks his head in, and I have acute hearing at this point, because and the book that I write, it's called The Five Laws, and it, later on in the book I mention these five laws, and I was very much aware of what was going on at this time. And this is one of the reasons why when someone loses their sight or their hearing, all the other senses kick in. Because these five laws, much like our senses, work independently. But much like your hand has five fingers, they all work together. And when you have a loss of one, the others are heightened. Because the laws must work. That's the way that nature is designed. And you cannot change them. And the reason why they're called laws is because they're like on top of everything. They run the show, right? That makes perfect sense.
Sure does.
And so my ability to hear was elevated because my ability to feel was taken down. And as I state in the book, I'm doing a little sidestep here. I explain how one of these laws can explain the other four. And that's literally what I was experiencing. Now, at the time I was 10, I didn't have the language for this. I was just picking up what was going on, but I was paying attention to it. And so here's this conversation. Here's what the doctor guy tells my dad. We don't know what happened. We think he stunned himself. He's perfectly okay. It just started snowing last night. You should probably take him out and go sled riding and make him forget about what happened. And
oh,
I'm
my
thinking
God.
To myself, what danger am I now in?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
And so what happens real quickly here is my dad comes over, and I tell him, I can't move. You're going to have to lift me. And so my dad has to pick me up to take me to the car. And I can feel within my dad he's in contention. He's like, the doctor's telling me one thing. I live in a world, a human society, where I'm supposed to listen to somebody who has a degree or has some kind of title because they happen to know more than me. They don't know what they don't know, remember? Key number one. But he's not been already trained into, forced into needing to understand this. So he's going along with the program of human society. So I'm supposed to listen to the doctor, even though my son can't move or anything. So he puts me in the car, takes me off to grandma's because he doesn't want to deal with me at all. There's too much going on here. So he wants to leave it up to, you know, being at grandma's house. So he puts me in a bed at grandma's house. Over the hours that I'm there, he's surprised that I don't eat and that and that I don't eat, meaning I'm not getting out of bed to eat, and that I've had other experiences where I've peed the bed. And so when he gets word that my mom and stepfather are finally going to be back in town at such and such time estimated, he's very happy to take me back to where I live with my mom. So I'm witnessing all of this going on, and these are the people who are supposed to take care of me. And this is what I've been taught for years. So my mom comes home, and she's a nurse. And she's aware, because she knows her son, there's something quite not right. She does the one thing that no one had done, which was sit me straight up in a chair in the kitchen while she was making me something to eat. Now, this did not happen immediately. But what happened was this. If you've seen pictures, or if you can relate to arcing with regards to welding, you have the two metals or two dissimilar metals, and you have that energy snap that kind of goes between the two lines.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the gap was that caused the disconnect, gravity was slowly allowing there to be some contact. Not enough for there to be any control, but some contact, such that I literally went from like the equivalent of a click of a finger from not being able to move or feel to having shooting pain running through my body and my body having convulsions like I was a fish out of water.
Oh, my God.
And my mom kind of holds me on the table, calls the ambulance, they get me to the hospital. And at the hospital, they basically say, would you stay still? And now, before they wouldn't take any x-rays or do anything, now they want to do the scans, but now they're angry at me because I can't stay still because this involuntary thing is going on. I still can't move or control myself, but it's happening independently, and I'm having these shooting pains that are running, you know, from the top of where my head is all the way down to my legs, my arms, my, you know, my fingers, my toes, and everything. It's a very surreal experience. And then it was calming down the more they had me laying down. And I'm not sure how long it took. They took their scans and x-rays and stuff. They couldn't find anything. Why? Back to third law of thinking. They didn't know what they didn't know, and they didn't want to investigate what they didn't know. And here's what they didn't know. They had already determined what my problem was. So therefore, they weren't looking for where the problem could be given the evidence that was there. They weren't looking at the facts. They were working on their opinions and theories that compounded ignorance. So thankfully, they said, we don't know what we're doing. There's a guy here who's a doctor who's well-known for figuring out tough cases. This is the guy we're going to talk to. Guy pulls up the x-rays. He says, this is your problem, guys. This boy, it's amazing he's alive and that we've been carrying him around like a rag doll and not listening to him. He has a hairline fracture, the C1, which is the vertebrae right next to the brainstem. And this is the one when you get in a car accident or when you dive into a pool and you hear somebody dies instantly, this is what's broken. So the fact that I was for 2 days carried around and all sorts of stuff, and I was still alive, then they wanted to take care of me. But I left one part of the story out. In this period between when these doctors who took the x-rays couldn't figure it out and they were able to get a hold of this other doctor, they put me in a room that didn't have a camera, but my mom said later on during my recovery, they were so out of it and not knowing what was the matter with you, they wanted to put you in a room with a camera because they thought you were making everything up. If what happened in 1987 happened now, I would be a 10-year-old that was a multi-zillionaire.
Yeah,
and what
I'd
say
so.
What I could do to sue him. But the fact that I was alive was, you know, the good thing. So, you know, in the nutshell, they decided they were going to chip out part of my hip. They were going to fuse it to my vertebrae with a wire and put me in traction and have me on my way to recover. And the continual problem that I had was I had this heightened level of perception and awareness, and I would ask questions, and I would know what I needed. But I recognized that as a 10-year-old, I knew what my body needed more than what the staff of the hospital was able to provide me. They did some things that were good. I mean, obviously, I recovered. But I had a lot of challenges overcoming their challenges. And that made me better, stronger, and more resilient to anyone who says, oh, I have this degree or I have this authority. I'm like, if you could prove it or you have evidence to show, that's great. But otherwise, it's just a title someone gave you and I don't believe it. And that allows me to say, I don't know what I don't know. I remain open. I can take in the information, but I'm not attached to it. Where everyone else is attached to what someone says, it hangs on it and believes it.
Well, what happened next?
Well, when I was in traction, actually, when I woke up, when I first wake up out of the surgery, a couple, you know, humorous things I could tell you. One, they don't like to communicate. What's going on? They tell me, okay, we're going to cut out part of your hip, we're going to do this and that, but they don't tell you the extra stuff. Now, no matter what the audience is here, to wake up with a catheter, which basically means your ability to exit your liquids from your body is controlled through a tube they put in you. But they didn't tell me. And the fact that my body was turned on again, sort of, but it was in the equivalent to a computer being rebooted, and that my body memory was somewhat lost. This is why people have to relearn how to do things, because your body has memory. And your body holds memory, such like when you develop the habit of, you know, putting on shoes, riding a bike. Once you develop the habit, your body holds the memory of what it is to do that. So from after that point forward, you can do that. Whereas I have in my mind what I used to do, but I had to retrain my body into a new body memory. And so waking up with like a catheter in me, I was like, what in the heck are you doing? You know, I saw the hip, but you're working in more than one place here, you know? So there were these things that were like, things like that, where they just normally do their thing, or like, you know, you get woke up every so many hours when you're in the hospital for craziest things. I think I felt like the human experiment, always getting the blood drawn and stuff like this. And, you know, they got me out of that hospital, put me in a recovery hospital, and I recovered in less than 6 months. It happened in early December, and I got back to school in around May and finished out the school year. And I was homeschooled for a while when I was up to a certain point where I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so from this period, when I'm younger, I pursue a normal childhood with this different bent on life. That I see the way the real world functions, nature, all these things that never fail and are always there, and this human society that teaches you one thing that doesn't know as if it's true or fact and goes along believing it. And then people wonder why they think things are so complicated and they're so stressed.
Well,
and it's a choice.
Yeah.
It's a choice. And the fact that I understood how the body is kind of like a computer far before really computers were discussed, that you have programs in your body that you install through actions that you create through a motivated instinct or intention with some incentive, which, you know, many people might call like inspiration. And usually your inspiration is out of a need or a desire. And a lot of it is subject to the environment you're in. If you're not aware of the way that the environment that you're in affects you, you're subject to that environment and what it can do to you. And I refer to this as the sponge effect. If you think of a sponge and its ability to hold water, when you're in an environment, you soak it up until you can't soak it up anymore, and you're saturated.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why people need to go to new environments and totally drain themselves out of their old environment and start reprogramming themselves in the habits that are serving them instead of serving others. And I don't look at it as good or bad, positive or negative, because good and bad or positive or negative have a lot of connotations that are really false, because what's good or bad or black or white to some person is the opposite for somebody else, given their condition. And I can name a half dozen examples of this. And like one of them is like, if you're heavy, eating a lot of food that's fatty is probably not so good for you if you're 300 pounds, right? Or you're overweight. Whereas
right.
The person who's extremely athletically inclined and has a lot of energy and their metabolism's buzzing, if they don't eat that same amount of food, they're going to be in a problem because their energy level is not going to be able to keep up with their body's intention.
Mm-hmm.
And you do the reverse of that. Someone who needs to eat less to lose weight, that seems good for one person, but they still need to eat, right? Whereas the person
right.
who's healthy might want to go on a fast and not eat anything, which for the person who is overweight and they don't eat, they'd probably be in rough shape because they don't have the ability to metabolize a lot of calories. That's why they got to eat so much because their system's all messed up, right? So it kind of goes both ways. And when you understand that, drop out the good and bad, look at what's beneficial to you and what's not beneficial to you. What works, what doesn't work, what you like, what you don't like, and keep it simple. Drop out all this complication stuff.
Well, I think that's the bottom line. And to me, any wisdom that's come to me is very simple. And, you know, I used to complicate the bejesus out of things. And,
your story is very inspiring. I'd like to ask you, I mean, we're coming toward the end of the hour and we haven't even talked about your human instruction manual, but I trust that you've gotten to the a lot of the points that might be in it in the telling of your story.
Yes.
So
yes.
Is there anything that you would like to say about it and also indicate a way that people can get in touch with you if they'd like to learn more?
Okay. Well, the first thing is my website's getontoit, G-E-T-O-N, the number 2, IT.com. It's a call to action to get onto it. In other words, to start whatever it is you want to start. And for most people, it's to start but actually living. Most people spend all their life in fear of death, but they never live. And that's what I try to get people to do. And I help them to become the hero on the inside that they're seeking on the outside. That's how that could take people from zero to hero. They don't see themselves as being a hero, then they develop that attitude and that intention and that understanding of who they are. All of a sudden, now they can be the hero they never knew they could be and that they were always looking on the outside for. The Human Instruction Manual is kind of like the baseline, the basic stuff reoriented that you've been taught, slightly shifted to give you what you need to unlock some of these barriers that you have that you put blocks up with. That you thought you knew what you knew and you bought into it. And the first one is called, part one is called The Five Laws. And I spend 80% of the first part of the book leading up to what these five laws, and I explain what these five laws are. And I explained that earlier. The next book is called The Creation Process. It basically says, once you understand these five laws, you can work with them instead of against them. Most of what you've been doing is working against them, even though you don't know that. And most people fail is not because they don't have the information. They don't have the information that they need. They have the information they think they need. And most people fail because they worry about how. Much like when I broke my neck, I tell people, don't worry about how. When you pick up a phone, do you care how it works or do you care why you want to use the phone? You dial in what it does and it does its thing. You don't worry about how the universe or the outside world is going to take care of you. You have to have the focus of why you want to do what you want to do, and that's your intention. You let how manifest itself. You can relate to other people's experiences in their hows to guide you, but your how and their how is never going to be the same. So that's what I cover in the second book. I'm actually in the process of almost being finished with the third book that I call the Carry Principle. And most of the book is a story. And it's a story that was personal to me that explains a lot of this carrying your burdens and these baggages that we hold on to and how that's very subtle and what it does to you. So it's got some good twists and turns and things like that. So I got that as far as available on Amazon. The third book isn't available on Amazon yet, but the first two are. On my website, you can get a hold of the audio version of the first book. The second audio version should be available within the end of the month. So I'm working on getting that going. And in addition to that, I have a handful of courses. I can work with anybody individually, and you can call me at 216-496-9494. I'll repeat that, 216-496-9494. And also, you can email me at Don, D-O-N, at getontoit, G-E-T-O-N, the number 2, IT.com. And anybody who references your show over the remaining balance of this month and is interested in anything on my website, if they give me an email and they sort of say, this is who I am, I heard you on the show, tell me something you found interesting, and kind of like a little bit about yourself, I'll give you a code that give you 50% off on my audio versions, a couple of my DVDs and courses and stuff like that. And
beautiful.
What I also want to point out is that I have everything on my website's this. If you go buy something, there's a couple longer courses. I'm not going to suggest that to anybody because they're really not ready for it until they get this earlier stuff. But there's a kind of like a DVD version that's online, and when somebody buys something, I just send them the URL, and then they can go to the URL, watch the video, listen to whatever is appropriate to what they're getting at their own leisure. And I have no problem with you sharing this with your friends and family, because once you start going down this road, you're going to want to work with other people that you know. The only thing that I ask is that you pass it on, and it's just about helping others, and we want to just let everyone know where it came from. That's it. And the idea here is that I like to work with people. I like to work with groups and companies. So if you can refer them and I'm helping you out, everybody wins, right? Serving everybody. Add that value. It's all great. There's two courses that run about 4 hours that I normally think are like $400 or $500. And like I said, it'd be half for anybody who – and if you've got like five people that want to get together, you know, five friends are listening to this, you know, you all chip in and it's reduced on the cost, right? I don't care. I like people to be creative. So whatever they got to do to do what it does to work for them. And these two courses are really pivotal. One of them's called The Five Needs. And it's the human need level of the five laws. And then the other course is called The Six Influences. And the six influences are this. We influence ourselves. And society influences us. We can't really try to control what society is trying to influence on us, because it's going to do what it's going to do. But we can control our own influence over ourselves. And if we understand these six influences, people want to control their life, people who really want to be this hero, people who really want to be empowered and maximized and what they can do, you need to understand these influences and how you influence yourself against yourself. And that's what that covers. So that's kind of everything in a nutshell. I'm not trying to sell myself. I think everything that I talked about sort of explains itself, and I'm just sharing.
Well, it's a real inspirational story, Don, and I really thank you for joining me tonight.
I appreciate the opportunity, David. And
my pleasure. Go ahead.
I just want anybody who listens to this to follow through with one thing that you've heard and go with it and start playing with it. And to recognize that your life's not going to change if you don't change. And I work with people because I want to help people, and I want them to be the best version they can be so that we can have a better world. It's not about me getting something out of it. The money comes out of just doing my job. It's not about the money. And there's a lot of people who do the motivation and inspiration stuff, and I call these the juice factory people. And I call them that because what they do is they juice you up with a bunch of hype, jumping up and down, all sorts of stuff, and you are left that you're not good enough, and you got to come back to them for more. With my stuff, you're not coming back to me for more because you don't feel like you're good enough. You feel like you're better, and every time you learn more about what I'm bringing to the table, you become better and better and better. And it's not about being juiced. It's about that you don't know what you don't know, and you have that curiosity of a child, and you want to continue to learn.
Well, thanks once again. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. All right.
All right. So once again, we come to a close. Let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we're all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, and God bless.